From the body cam of the officers talking amongst themselves, that there were multiple undercover officers who had infiltrated us. And so I shared that with my co-defendants, my fellow organizers, and that was a huge break in the case for our understanding of just how thoroughly our constitutional rights had been violated.
Well, we're going to continue with part two of this discussion and post it at democracynow.org. We want to thank Jacqueline Armendariz-Enzueta, a Colorado Springs community organizer, a plaintiff in the new ACLU of Colorado lawsuit, and Trevor Aronson. We'll continue with you as well. Award-winning investigative journalist. Will link to your new piece for The Intercept, Lawsuit Targets FBI Probe of Racial Justice Activists. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're tuned into listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Finance Committee will meet twice in August via public video conference. The Finance Committee meeting will be on Thursday, August 10th at 5:30, and again on Thursday, August 24th at 5:30 p.m. A public link and phone number to attend the virtual meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, one more time, Trump stands before a judge and says he's not guilty. Oregon lawmakers are speaking out on the benefits of the semiconductor industry with a promise of good-paying jobs. And how heat kills, especially those behind bars. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, August 3rd, 2023. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us tonight. For the third time, former President Donald Trump stood before a judge on criminal charges. He pleaded not guilty to charges that he broke the law by trying to overturn the results of the 2020 election. A judge arraigned him on the charges, accusing him of conspiring to stay in office despite losing the election. He faces this prosecution in the Capitol, a city that remembers the attack from his supporters on January 6th. Jurors will be drawn from residents of the District of Columbia. As the cases against President Trump proceed, a new legal fight looms over democracy in Wisconsin, a state that was critical in both of the elections involving him. Mike Moen reports that its gerrymandered maps are soon to go before the state Supreme Court.
This week's indictment of former President Donald Trump has renewed calls to protect core functions of democracy. In Wisconsin, those behind a new lawsuit say their action addresses another threat to a fair election system, partisan gerrymandering. The liberal organization Law Forward, along with Democratic voters from around the state, has filed a petition with Wisconsin's Supreme Court to overturn legislative districts drawn by Republicans. The move was expected since an April election that shifted ideological balance of the court. Law Forward's Jeff Mandel says the redistricting outcomes, which have benefited the GOP for more than a decade, are an affront to democracy.
Every day that it continues is a violation of the most fundamental rights of every Wisconsinite.
Mandel says if recent gerrymandering seen in the U.S. had been stopped earlier, some of the efforts to undermine the democratic process, such as the allegations in the Trump indictment, might not have come to pass. Meanwhile, in response to the Wisconsin court filing, Senate Majority Leader Devin LeMahieu, a Republican, says the plaintiffs are counting on a judicial fiat to gain power. The senator contends the current maps are valid and constitutional. However, Mark Gaber, who leads redistricting efforts for the Campaign Legal Center, points out that for several years now, Wisconsin's political maps have been skewed in such a way that voters have never had a legitimate chance to elect a Democratic majority for the legislature.
Not just the Democratic voters of Wisconsin, but independents and Republicans who might sometimes wish to switch their views in a certain election.
In last year's election, Republicans won 64 of 99 assembly seats, along with 22 of 33 state Senate seats. That's despite Democratic victories in 3 of 5 statewide elections. Currently, the plaintiffs are not asking the court to address Wisconsin's congressional maps. That hasn't been ruled out. Republicans have captured most of the U.S. House districts in Wisconsin. Mike Moen, Wisconsin News Connection.
Before the passage of a new law, more than 90,000 Nevada adults were not allowed to vote in 2016. But a recently passed bill will require jails in the nearby state to develop ways for inmates to register to vote and cast ballots. Alex Gonzalez has the story.
Starting next year, a Nevada bill will require city and county jails to develop a streamlined process and procedures for inmates to register to vote and cast a ballot. In 2019, the state assembly passed a law that restored voting rights to Nevadans with felony convictions after they completed their sentences, instead of having to wait 2 years for their civil right to be restored. Emily Prasad Zamora with Silver State Voices, a nonprofit organization committed to civic engagement advocacy, says they observed that many Nevadans still didn't realize they had a legal right to vote.
Some jails, you know, we saw that were doing more than others, but it wasn't uniform across the board, right? And I think that it was clear to us that, like, not every single inmate knew that they had this right.
Prasad Zamora says they saw the need for jails to be informing more and advising inmates that they have the right to register to vote. Prasad Zamora says they reached out to Democratic Assemblywoman Brittany Miller of Las Vegas, who championed the legislation, and adds that bipartisan support also helped ensure the bill was passed during this last legislative session. Prasad Zamora says Assembly Bill 286 is about what she calls setting the record straight. She says many were confused as to why the legislation was needed if the Nevada Constitution already stated inmates had this right, to which Prasad Zamora says there exists a lack of awareness. She says she's confident this bill will help.
The wardens will have to point you to the right direction and how you get registered to vote. If you are in jail while there is an election and you have already registered to vote, you have the right to request a ballot.
Prasad Zamora says the ballot will be a mail-in ballot that is delivered to the inmate. She adds the original bill also set out to allow inmates to vote electronically and would have created a polling site in local jails, but both of those items were omitted in the final rule. I'm Alex Gonzalez.
More Native students have options for higher education tuition breaks, but some tribes are left out of this growing movement. Eric Tegedoff tells us how it's affecting members of tribes in Oregon and Washington.
States are offering to cover college costs for students from federally recognized tribes, including Oregon, which established the Tribal Student Grant Program last year. However, an estimated 400 tribes across the country aren't recognized by the U.S. government. Natalie Pate, a reporter at Oregon Public Broadcasting, wrote about this issue for the Hechinger Report.
As a result, the Native students who are part of those tribes are not getting the same opportunities as their peers and are left with a disproportionate amount of debt if they do decide to pursue higher education, and many are choosing not to.
The Oregon Tribal Student Grant applies to the 9 federally recognized tribes in Oregon. Individual universities in the state, including Western Oregon University, Oregon State University, and Portland State University, have extended in-state tuition to the more than 570 federally recognized tribes across the U.S. Pate says many tribal members who aren't recognized choose to forgo college because of the cost.
There's definitely this feeling of isolation and separation and feeling like another line has been drawn and they are put on the wrong side of it, or the side that is going to make it so they don't get the same access to education and job opportunities.
Pate notes that Oregon allows members of the Chinook Indian Nation, which isn't currently recognized federally, to access in-state tuition costs. She says some tribes like the Duwamish in Washington have offered financial assistance internally, but more could be done on a greater scale.
In terms of big picture solutions, we're looking at institutions and state leaders trying to find some of those solutions so it can impact as many students who are wanting to go to school as possible.
For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
For both education and the economy, lawmakers are touting the semiconductor industry as one of the most promising for Oregon's future. This week, Oregon State Representative Janelle Bynum, Congresswoman Suzanne Bonamici, and U.S. Senator Ron Wyden brought that message to a celebration of 1 year since the CHIPS Act passed in Congress. Here's some of what they said at OMSI in Portland.
I remember her telling me, so you're not going to be an engineer anymore? And I was like, Mom, once an engineer, always an engineer. And so 20 years later, this project was a labor of love, maybe a love letter to my mother to say that I was still in the game, I'm still working for girls in STEM, for HBCU kids in STEM, and so that is the love and passion that I brought to this project. As a state legislator and Florida A&M, which is an HBCU-educated electrical engineer, I'm thrilled today to stand beside this amazing group of leaders as we celebrate the Federal CHIPS Act that passed just about 1 year ago. And thanks to the leadership of Senator Wyden and Representative Bonamici, the Oregon legislature has provided the tools and the playbook necessary to make Oregon the preeminent leader in semiconductor technology and advanced manufacturing. So with the shared vision of prosperity for all Oregonians, the state legislature passed Senate Bill 4 with bipartisan support, to allocate over $200 million to support our semiconductor industry and attract our federal CHIPS grants to the state. Even then, in the final minutes of session, we also passed two semiconductor workforce investments that I'm proud to highlight today. First, through the Senate Bill 5506, we allocated a $2 million grant for the nonprofit Building Blocks to Success for the purpose of building a semiconductor workforce pipeline program focused on summer programming and college prep. And then we had a second grant of $1.2 million that was allocated to Self Enhancement Inc. to develop an underserved and underrepresented youth cohort to build a pipeline of diverse students who will be ready to gain employment in Oregon's ever-expanding semiconductor industry. And so I'm proud to say that these allocations represent a dedication to ensuring the workforce of the future will include those who were previously unable to participate in the bounties of the semiconductor industry. So we were ambitious, and our ambitions were to expand the state's footprint in the semiconductor field, and we also did that with investments at Oregon State University. So this wasn't just about Beaverton or Hillsboro, this is about the entire state. So while our job is not finished yet, and further work is needed to be done to capitalize on the moment, we deserve to celebrate today and be proud of what we've already accomplished and look forward with excitement to what our future holds. And yes, Mom, I'm still an engineer and we're still going to keep pushing. Thanks, everybody. So I serve on the Committee on Science, Space, and Technology. I also served along with the Senator on the Conference Committee. I represent the Silicon Forest, which I'm very proud of, and appreciate Oregon's leadership in the semiconductor industry because we know the value of the industry to our economy. It was an honor to have Secretary Raimondo here. We were thrilled to have her visit, and I know, as the Senator said, she was impressed not just with the industry overall, but with our research, with our collaboration, and importantly, with our workforce. We have people here prepared to work in this industry, and it was thrilling to have her at Portland Community College and see the programs there. So we see benefits from this industry, not just here in the metro area or in the Silicon Valley area. We see them ripple across the state. The people employed in the industry, they have pride in their work, they know the power of innovation, crafting the future, and they appreciate, as we all do, the family wage jobs. I'm thrilled to see students learning in community college programs and pre-apprenticeships and apprenticeships and every path possible to get into this industry. And the CHIPS Act is making this all even more possible. So I'm excited about the investments. I know we're also celebrating the investments and the good work of the legislature led by Representative Bynum in the House, Senator Solman in the Senate. And I know she wishes she could be here today because that pair, they were the dynamic duo, continue to get it done. So I want to note that my Building STEAM Education Act was included in the law, and this is to talk about the benefit of integrating arts and design into STEM learning.
It increases the potential for more creative workers and also a more diverse workforce. And I think we're going to see future generations inspired to get into this field. And some of them are probably at OMSI camp right now. Some of our future workers in the semiconductor industry are innovators, are creators. So I'm excited, very excited about the future growth. The partnership between the state and the federal government has been amazing. The industry, Analog, is here today. Intel and so many other semiconductor businesses and the supply chain and supporting businesses that will all see benefits. So I'm excited, looking forward to see more investments here in Oregon and to grow and solidify our state's leadership. So thank you for the opportunity to celebrate with you all today, and I'll turn it back over to our next.
I don't want to make this a bouquet tossing contest, but I think we ought to understand what a treasure OMSI is to the people of Oregon. And let's give a big shout out for Aaron. And I can't hear you very well. Okay, a little better. Five Wyden children, three of them still pretty young. Love coming here, Aaron, and it's a tribute to all of you. I'm going to make this a filibuster-free zone and make just a few comments. We've got the NBA All-Stars of Innovation and Science. My colleague, Congresswoman Bonamici, President Benning, our wonderful state legislator, Janelle Bynum. So you got the NBA All-Stars here of chips and the like. And let me just make a couple of comments. First, semiconductors have had a banner week in Oregon. If you add up what's happened in the last week alone, the announcement at Intel, major new capital investment in Hillsboro, potential for thousands of new good-paying jobs. Last week, Analog Devices provided the latest example of our state's pivotal role, announcing a billion-dollar expansion at the Beaverton campus. Big win for the metro area. I'm sure Representative Bynum is going to take us through the incredible work that is being done at the state. The governor made a big announcement this week in terms of major investments. And the list goes on. And in particular, I'm so proud of the fact that when the Commerce Secretary, Gina Raimondo, accepted my invitation to come to Oregon, the entire state mobilized. Nobody did a better job than President Benning, because what a showcase at the community college. And get this, the Secretary of Commerce left Oregon, and as she went around the country, and this has been in the press, she said, it is unbelievable what is being done in Oregon. So that's a little bit of excitement. For me, the story always also comes back to that press conference I had at Stark's Vacuum Cleaner about a year or so ago, because we all know that domestic chips are used in robot vacuums, but there's such a great history in Oregon, decades and decades of that kind of company that is going to grow and prosper in the days ahead. I'm going to make just one other quick comment and then allow my colleagues to talk. We're also competing very, very well for the technology grants that go right to the heart of what we've been strong at in Oregon. And advanced lithography, we can go through some of the nuances of what that's all about, but you can't have semiconductors in the lead from a competitive standpoint without advanced lithography. I have talked to the Secretary of Commerce at least four separate times about Oregon's competitiveness for advanced lithography. So that's what's coming up. But I'm telling you, by the way, it's only Wednesday, but Oregon has had one heck of a week in terms of semiconductors. This is a banner time, and it couldn't be more fitting because it goes right in to the anniversary of the CHIPS Act. The Congresswoman and I were on the conference committee on that, and in the conference agreement is a key part of Oregon's future. And I'll close with this. I'm chairman of the Senate Finance Committee. we were able to include a $24 billion investment tax credit in manufacturing in the semiconductor space. The reason that's so important is, as all of my colleagues know, we have always excelled on the technology side. We are going to continue to excel on the technology side, but we're also in the big leagues now in terms of manufacturing.
And we just heard from Oregon State Representative Janelle Bynum, Congresswoman Suzanne Bonamici, and U.S. Senator Ron Wyden. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News In-Depth. We'll have Mel's Global Citizen Interview Digest and then an interview about the Washington Park Summer Festival. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, American Indian Airwaves. Tonight's weather, we'll see a few passing clouds, a low of 61. Tomorrow's weather, partly sunny skies, a high all the way up to 90. Today in history, on this date in 1958, a U.S. nuclear submarine traveled under the North Pole for the first undersea voyage there, nearly 1,000 miles under the Arctic ice cap. Our quote of the day is from Will Steger. Within 10 years, it will be impossible to travel to the North Pole by dog team. There will be too much open water. As the world learns more about the impact of heat and climate change, a new report that rising temperatures are having severe, even deadly impacts on the prison population, Edwin J. Vera reports.
Longer heat waves across the country are an increasing problem. Mike Wessler with the Prison Policy Initiative notes the country's prison population is aging and not as able to withstand the heat. He says alternatives to incarceration should be considered as a first step for reducing heat-related deaths in prisons.
Identify those folks who don't need to be behind bars and find alternatives. If somebody commits a crime, putting them behind bars for years at a time in inhumane conditions is not the only way you can rectify them.
Additionally, he says new prisons should be built with air conditioning and access to showers and other cooling conditions need to be expanded. However, global temperatures have risen from 2013 to 2021, with each year being hotter than the last. Scientists at the World Meteorological Organization said this past July was the hottest month on record because of heat waves across North America, Europe, and Asia. Court cases have been brought forward about the lack of cooling conditions in times of excessive heat, violating a person's Eighth Amendment rights. Wessler notes that in spite of lawmakers knowing the steps to take, there are some challenges to ensuring these initiatives come to fruition.
There's a contingent of folks who kind of believe if you have committed a crime, you just have to deal with whatever conditions come your way. And I think that is not something that most people agree with. I think most people agree that if you commit a crime and are incarcerated, you still have your basic humanity and still have a right to a safe prison facility.
I'm Edwin J. Vieira.
Former Vice President Mike Pence says crackpot lawyers fueled efforts to overturn the 2020 election. Michigan Republican officials are charged with tampering with voting machines. With more on the stories affecting our democracy, here's today's edition of 2023 Talks.
I know in my heart of hearts that I did my duty under the Constitution, irrespective of what President Trump has said for the last 2.5 years.
Former Vice President Mike Pence weighed in on the latest federal indictments against former President Donald Trump Wednesday, saying Trump was surrounded by a group of crackpot lawyers who claimed Pence had the right to overturn the 2020 presidential election results. Pence says he was unaware of efforts at the time to secure fake electors in states across the country. A former Republican state attorney general candidate and former Republican state representative from Michigan have been charged in connection with efforts to tamper with voting machines after the 2020 election. Michigan Secretary of State Jocelyn Benson tells CNN attempts to tamper with voting machines are efforts to disrupt democracy.
I think we've seen on every level a lot of evidence that this is a nationally coordinated effort.
Prosecutors say people breached election systems in Michigan, Georgia, and Colorado. U.S. Capitol Police say more than 200 officers responded to what they are now calling a bad 911 call of an active shooter in the Hart Senate building Wednesday. No evidence of a shooter was found. Both the House and Senate are currently in recess. A group of parents and faith leaders in Oklahoma have filed a lawsuit to prevent the state's support of what would be the nation's first religious public charter school. The Reverend Lori Walke of Oklahoma City tells Fox News state funding of the school would be an assault on the separation of church and state.
The school choice movement is really rooted in completely defunding and dismantling our public school system, and that is a threat to us all.
The school was approved by a state charter school board last month, despite the state's Republican Attorney General warning it would violate the state's constitution. I'm Catherine Carley.
Education is vital for democracy, but in Florida, new teachings about slavery are being criticized as offensive and distorting the brutal reality. Jermell Gomes reports on the controversy.
As Governor Ron DeSantis promotes claims that enslaved people develop skills for their personal benefit and is requiring those teachings to middle schoolers, more groups are vehemently condemning the new standards. The Virgil Hawkins Florida Chapter National Bar Association, which represents black attorneys, issued a joint statement from its 9 affiliate members expressing deep concerns. Cornelius Demps with the George Edgecombe Bar Association in Hillsborough County says children need to know the full story of slavery and its impact,
including how slavery impacted African Americans, how they were treated as chattel, how they were abused, tortured, entire bloodlines have been taken away, people stripped of their identity coming from the African continent, and then having to find their own way and forge their own future.
DeSantis has ignored the concerns of black conservatives, suggesting his critics are intentionally misinterpreting the language while pointing out that William B. Allen, a black professor emeritus at Michigan State University, worked on the new standards and is defending the wording. Demps wants to see the State Board of Education revise its policy to tell the truth, but if the board insists on keeping the current narrative, he thinks they should tell the full story.
What happened during Reconstruction, the passage of Jim Crow laws, how African Americans were at post-Civil War were one of the largest ethnic groups in the country, skilled laborers, why weren't they able to achieve more? And that's their discussion about how the impact of discrimination for years has continued on.
DeSantis has been doubling down, claiming Vice President Kamala Harris' recent visit to the state was to score cheap political points. His campaign has gone on the attack against critics, including black Republican Congressman Byron Donalds. Meanwhile, Florida schools have approved the use of supplemental curriculum created by PragerU, an unaccredited conservative-leaning advocacy group that seeks to offer an alternative to dominant left-wing ideologies. This is Tramell Gomes.
An effort to encourage Congress to extend a diabetes program. A Rochester museum apologizes during a repatriation ceremony, and vulnerable people are evacuated from wildfires. With these stories and more, here's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
Navajo Nation President Boone Igren is advocating for the reauthorization of the special diabetes program for Indians and for increased funding. He recently testified before the U.S. Congress Joint Economic Committee in Washington, D.C. The Navajo Nation has the largest reservation in the U.S., located in the Four Corners region, and is one of the largest tribes with more than 400,000 Navajo citizens. Nigren says his community has a burdensome legacy of health disparities, including obesity, diabetes, heart disease, and cancer, which he says are linked to colonization, forced assimilation, and displacement.
Historically, our communities thrived on farming, herding, and hunting and gathering. These traditional practices provided us with nutritious foods that sustained us for generations. However, this way of life has been systematically eroded over time as processed foods high in fat, sugar, and salt have replaced all our traditional food sources. This, compounded by poverty, unemployment, and the lack of transportation, has amplified the health disparities we face today.
Nigren says the special diabetes program, established more than 25 years ago, has helped the Navajo Nation, but diabetes remains a public health problem.
The special diabetes program for Indians is the gold standard when it comes to diabetes treatment and broadly considered one of the most effective public health programs ever created. We urge you to consider human faces behind the statistics, our elders, our children, and our family. They all look to you and hope that their government will continue to support them in their fight against this devastating disease.
Nigren says he supports efforts to reauthorize the program for 2 years at $170 million per year. The committee also heard from witnesses who testified about the economic cost of the disease in the U.S., the role of health and nutrition programs in prevention and treatment, and the role of pharmaceutical interventions. The Oneida Indian Nation in New York and the Rochester Museum and Science Center held a ceremony Wednesday to repatriate remains from the museum to the Oneida Nation. During the ceremony, the museum apologized for the acquisition of the remains and cultural artifacts. Oneida Nation Representative Ray Halbritter says the repatriation is more than a return. He says it's an acknowledgement of them as real people who lived and deserve dignity in life and death. He says it's also a chance to recognize failures and for institutions to take accountability and make amends. The museum's president, Hillary Olson, says it was a significant occasion as museums recognize the trauma they've caused, including excavation, collection, study, and display of Native Americans and their belongings. Olson says museums can acknowledge the unjust legacy of the past and take steps toward repairing harms. 19 remains were returned from various times in history between 200 and 3,000 years ago. The museum says they were excavated, donated, or purchased decades ago and had remained there ever since. In 2000, 25 remains from the museum were returned to the Oneida Nation. The Fond du Lac Dene Sulin Nation in northern Saskatchewan has moved 300 members out of the community due to wildfire smoke, the Canadian Press reports. Those evacuated are people with compromised health issues. Indigenous Services Canada, the Canadian Red Cross, and Prince Albert Grand Council are offering support. Clean air shelters and air purifiers are being made available to residents still in the community. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, August 3rd, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Eric Tegedoff, Edwin J. Biera, Mike Moen, Tramel Gomes, and Alex Gonzalez. The producers Annette Newell and our engineers Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The director of evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/evening news. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. Glad you chose to join us. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If